Okay, let's get started. Good evening. Welcome, everyone, to the 529 Emergency Preparedness Discussion Net, courtesy of the WA7ABU 529 repeater. This is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo. My name is Brett, and I'm net control for today, June 16th, 2020. This net meets each Tuesday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. local time on 145.29 megahertz. This is a designated emergency frequency, so we'll break if any real emergency occurs. Our alternate frequency is 145.19 with a tone of 100. We appreciate those who stand by and allow us to have a clear frequency for the next hour as we discuss emergency preparedness, updates on the COVID-19 pandemic, and other topics of interest to you regarding emergency preparedness. Tonight, you just get me, Brett. Sheila will return when we have significant health updates and things that we need to go over, but again, I will be taking questions. Anything I don't know as far as the health questions, I will pass on to her, and we'll get an answer for you. Anyway, all amateur operators are welcome to participate in discussions during the net. Again, I'd like it to be more interactive. People, can give their questions and opinions, and we can bring up some new topics besides COVID-19 if you'd like. Pretty much open to that. So feel free to change the subject after you've heard enough. Again, we try to stay away from real political decisions that we don't have much control over, but some decisions affect our ability to remain safe and to make good judgment calls. So that's what we try to focus on. Okay, so let's see. Well, I wanted to go over some news here with you guys, and I need to find my phone here. There's been a couple of, I'm just sort of going over the Oregon news. I guess the important thing to probably hear is that, we're starting to see cases increase in terms of testing positive for COVID. Yes, there are increasing numbers of cases in various spots. And, it's one of these things that we're starting to, confusing a little bit because, some of the government people are saying, well, that's only because we're testing more, I mean, of course, if you're going to test more, you're going to see more cases, right? And that is true, but in this case, this there actually is over and above the normal amounts. And I wanted to find something that I've got an article from the Washington Post here that Sheila had sent me, and I'm trying to see if I can pull that back up for you again. Now, if anybody saw that the data on this, it's a little bit confusing because you see, it's just because you're testing more, but it's not just a function of testing. So there's a, again, I don't know if you saw this Washington Post article about this or not, but what they do is if you look at the 7-day average of new cases, there are particular states, the average number of new cases increased, while in some cases like Kentucky, Missouri, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, and Wyoming, their new cases has increased since May 31st, while the number of daily tests actually declined. In 14 other states, the rate of new cases is increasing faster than the increase in the average number of tests. So, again, you got to look at averages, and you do see that averages are more important to look at because than a daily result. That's because, they do send out batches of tests, and then they get back batches of results. And so you'll get, a day where there's a big reporting of a, large number of cases. And that's happened in Oregon. We're seeing certain counties that I'm going to go over the Oregon data. Sorry, KG7GDB, timed it out there. But again, they're starting to look at the 7-day average, and again, that's you want to look at the the number of new cases per day on average, and we definitely are seeing an upward trend in a lot of areas, and you know, and some of those get a lot of news reports. So, you know, in terms of looking at the data, it's kind of interesting because she also gave me sort of an important statistic for you guys, because we talk about, well, see, it must be going on long enough now that, you know, the risk is going down, right? I mean, still, as a percentage of our population, not that many people have actually tested positive yet, okay? You know, we haven't gotten to that many people, you know, so it's like 2 million people that are positive, but that only represents a very, very tiny amount of our country. Okay, so that's the thing, is that it's still out there, okay? And so we're seeing cases go back up because people have changed their behavior. They're relaxing the restrictions that we've placed on people staying home, and they're going back, and the numbers of cases are going up. So, but what is this, you know, again, what is the statistic that matters to us in terms of our healthcare? Is probably the rate of hospitalizations, the number of admitted patients. That's not one that gets reported a lot, but we can have that information is reported to us by the Oregon Health Authority if you've gone to their website. First of all, you know, you can go to this Oregon Health Authority has a lot of data now, okay, data dashboards, and you can look at all the sort of the total amounts, and it does vary a lot by county, and it's not, you know, if we look at us compared to a lot of people, you know, around the country, you know, we haven't had that many cases, we haven't had that many deaths compared to many places, okay? However, you know, there are differences from county to county. There have been, you know, outbreaks in certain counties, and, you know, some places, like, you'd think that, well, numbers would be based completely on population. But another thing that they do is they actually express the case rate, per case count per 10,000 people. And what you find is that, yes, they're right now, they're one of the worst spots right now is a place that doesn't have very many people right now. Out in, I think this is Umatilla County. They had 240 positive cases, and they only have 26,000 people living there. So they have a pretty dang high case count right now in Union County. Okay, that's because there was a large church organization that was doing some testing, and they ended up with a lot of cases. So it's like, you know, so you can look at this data dashboard. It color codes the different counties. But, you know, if you compare, like, you know, here we are in Marion County is not, we have a lot of cases, compared to our population, and we're up there, actually, you know, our population in Marion County, that is 347,000, approximately, you know, and we've got, 1,158 positive tests. Totally 1,200, you know, cases. But if you compare that with Multnomah County, we actually have more. We're 34 cases per 10,000. Multnomah County, which has a bigger population, has 19 cases per. So that's basically, there's 821,000 people in Multnomah County, and they have 1,500 cases, okay? So ours is pretty high in Marion County for our population. So it doesn't just so something's happening there a little bit. But any comments on the expression of how we look at the county data or the differences?
K6SDX.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
So we got this X amount of cases. Bottom line is, how many of those cases actually are in the hospital?
Oh. Okay, that's a different statistic, and that's a good, very good point. That's the one I would like you to focus on. Okay, so if you look at there, you have to look at something called the severe disease burden. Okay, that's what they call it here. Okay, now there's different. You know, they have the COVID-19 burden, and then they have something called the COVID-19 severe disease burden. Okay, and they actually have the number of hospitalizations, and they kind of average it over 28 days, and they're pointing out that there's a moving average for the whole group, okay? We can look it up any individual county. But I can tell you that, you know, what they've shown is our moving average, you know, went up, and then it's sort of going down a little bit. But these are between, like, 5, 6, and 7 hospitalizations per day, okay? But there are, in Marion County and Multnomah County, Umatilla County and Washington County and Clackamas County, those are the worst ones. They all have greater than 5 hospitalizations in the past 28 days. So there are certain counties where the hospitalization rate is higher, and that's the one that we want to see, that number of hospitalizations go down over 14 days without any uptrend in the past week. So when you look at some of the criteria, and they have actually something called public health indicators, and you know, it's kind of based on our opening recommendations and the trends that they're looking for. So I'll just tell you that they have a whole map of you know, which counties meet all the indicators for opening up, okay, and some of which don't meet the criteria. So supposedly, if you've got meet all the criteria, and I can go over those with you guys, then yeah, you can qualify for the next opening phase. If you don't, then they recommend that you you don't meet that, and you can't go to the next phase.
Okay, you got to straighten something out for me here. I got another question. K6SDX.
Okay, this is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo. I'm not going to bore you here with numbers a little bit. But anyway, the point is that Oregon statewide, you know, obviously we don't all meet, all the counties don't meet all the indicators for opening up. But there are, you know, for example, I'll just keep picking on Marion County since we live here. I take responsibility for it. So Marion County has had a 38% increase in new cases in the last 7 days. It should be no more than 5%, okay? On the contrary, Lane County, which has a similar population, is down 60% on cases. Okay, so they meet that. Actually, Lane County meets all the criterion. Okay, you know, so each one of these indicators you can take a look at. Trend in hospitalizations of the last 14 days should, you know, again, Lane County no uptrend. Marion County has an uptrend. Okay. So we're missing out on two out of the 6 criterion. So, you know, for going to the next phase, you know, Polk County, for example, meets 5 out of 6. They've had 33% case increases the last 7 days. Again, no, should be no more than 5. Anyway, that's what you get when you start looking at it. That, you know, yeah, there are places that are fine. You know, they're doing okay. Other places are not, and that's what we need to keep an eye on. Okay. So, Dan, you had another question.
So we have this uptake of a lot of other people getting this virus here in Marion County. So obviously they're not all ending up in the hospital. So they get the virus and they go through their 14-day or one-month thing, and they get a bit ill, and then they kind of recover. After that period of time, how contagious are they? Are they just not contagious whatsoever, and it's just like nothing ever happened after that? Where do they sit in this situation, or do we still have to be wary of these people still running around?
Okay, well, that's a very good question, because, and I don't think we have a perfect answer for you there, okay, because we don't have enough people. So what the next step is after, and part of this public health indicator, is that we need to go we need to follow up the cases, with contact tracing, okay? And so, for instance, actually, one of the criteria is that we need to follow up with these patients within 24 hours, and they should, they want 95% of the patients who have been tested positive to be seen. So, actually, most of the we're doing pretty well in terms of that. Oregon statewide, 96% of the people are followed up within 24 hours after testing positive. The only one county that's showing that didn't do that was Lincoln County, 71%. Now they had a huge number that they had 250% increase in. Lincoln County, 1,914% increase when they found out the big seafood factory probably. So they haven't gotten around to figuring out what happened with all those people. So we need to do that contact tracing and find out, who they were around and follow up on them and see what happens. Unfortunately, what we're trying to say is that there's some criteria as far as nationally. We have recommendations for, when you should go back to work and when you should test positive and negative. But because there is a significant number of people who test negative, after you start, obviously don't show any symptoms necessarily until when you do, they test you, and then you may or may not test positive. And then once the symptoms go away, they're supposed to test you again. It would be, in some cases, they say you have to have two tests within 72 hours, that are both negative after being able to go back to work for certain agencies. We don't know still whether those people would continue to be infective. But I can tell you just here's a little personal anecdote. Let me get a drip. Yeah, my daughter has a friend that lives in Colorado who is doing some public health work in a part of a military unit. And he got COVID, and it wasn't a young guy. And, he felt ill and went in, tested, had COVID. But he recovered, just like people with the flu would recover. Didn't have a lot of difficulties from it, fever, chills, fatigue. Felt better, and then basically after 48 hours, he asked to go back to work. And, they said, yeah, well, that's good. We need you to go back to work because, we're short on staff and we need all the people we can get. So he went back and I know my daughter yelled at him and said, what do you mean going back? You just had it. How do you know you're not infected still? And that's the question. We don't know. And, 14 days is kind of like, well, that really would be waiting probably long enough for them not to be infectious anymore. But going back to work after 72 hours, we don't really know. That's a big unanswered question as to whether they still remain infectious at that point in time.
Okay, so that brings up a question. If after, say 3 weeks of quarantine or maybe even a month that they're out but they originally tested positive and you go through this period of getting sick but you don't end up in the hospital but you've finally recover and you're feeling okay, and say a month goes by, if you get retested then, do you test positive or negative?
Well, for the most part, I think people test negative, but there have been some people some of the ones famously, like on the cruise ship, that tested positive and continued to test positive even though they feel fine. That's what they call the asymptomatic positive testing. If you're testing positive, you still could theoretically be, you are shedding viral particles, right? So we don't know, how infective you are. The thought is that people who are actively showing symptoms and, especially through, coughing and things like that are more likely to spread the virus than people who are, not breathing hard or you just think from a mechanical standpoint, they're spewing more. viruses. But the thought is that if you're testing negative and you've tested it multiple times, you know, you pretty much probably don't have any more virus that you're shedding if it's a good test. Now, if it's this rapid test, that has a kind of a high false negative rate. And so that's, again, the problem. The guy said, well, we'll go back and take my rapid negative test, and I was near a rapid test, and it was negative. So those aren't as sensitive. But you would hope that they wouldn't be contagious at that point in time. But I think to be prudent, you'd wait 14 days. And, you're ultimately responsible for making other people sick, right? So, you sometimes people think that, well, you know, I'm no longer can get ill. I mean, probably can't, but again, we don't have enough data to tell whether you can be reinfected. But if it works like other kinds of viruses, you usually have a period of immunity. We're really kind of hoping that, yeah, you're not going to get reinfected. But that, again, we don't have a lot of data. We're right now just getting an understanding of the way this stuff works, and we're starting to see, you know, what are the differences? Who are the people that get sick, and who doesn't get sick? And there's been some interesting news about that I wanted to talk about tonight on that. That's Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. Any other comments on that before we move on to this idea of, you know, kind of the newer information about, let's see if any other comments at this point. Okay, so the other thing Sheila mentioned to me that she sent me this thing about that. So again, listening to the claims of the government saying to us, just don't worry about it. We're seeing more cases because we're testing more. That's not true. Okay, you can do the fact check on that. The second thing is that this is what Sheila sent to me. Based on the current U.S. fatality rate, in order to achieve herd immunity, assuming 60% of the population infected, we would have to have 10,436,760 deaths, the current death rate, U.S. fatality rate. Isn't that an amazingly number? To get 60% immunity, we're going to lose that many people. Anyway, you know, it's based, you know, on the idea that, you know, we have 300 million people in the United States, and to get 60% of them, you know, having had the disease, that there is a percentage of the people who will die, right? So, and that's a big number, 10%. So, that's a sobering thought, and I don't think that, we're really going to want to tolerate that. So that's why we're trying to keep track of this stuff, okay? Now, a couple of things have come out in the news the last few days that are interesting about some good news. And first thing is that we've been getting some, there's in Oxford in England, has been testing different kinds of therapies. And they found that a very commonly used drug that's used in the intensive care unit actually conferred some benefit to people who were on respirators and needed oxygen therapy. The standard steroid called dexamethasone, which is an inexpensive drug used a lot for anti-inflammation, there were 30% fewer deaths of people who were treated with this steroid when they were in the intensive care unit. And those are people who are on ventilators or need the oxygen therapy. So those are the most severe cases, but there was 30% fewer deaths from people who received that common medication. So that is a treatment, okay, for at least for the severely ones, it seems to work. Okay, the same agency came out the week before and said that, our hydroxyquinoquine does not work. They showed absolutely no difference between the group treated with hydroxychloroquine, the malaria treatment, and the group that was not, again, in hospitalized patients. So, and then today also on the news was that the FDA withdrew their emergency authorization of that medicine for a treatment of COVID. So it's really not a treatment for COVID. So we can scratch that one from the list. But there are other things that they're looking at. They found some interesting genetic differences lately. We're getting some basic science stuff, which is good. And they tested the, again, blood. They tend to focus on the people they can study, the people in the hospital. Let me get a drip. So there was another study that came out. Again, I think it was this was a German study that came out and said that they're looking at the differences between people who were hospitalized, if they could find any genetic markers. So they had, you know, blood samples from people who were hospitalized versus control group, and they did find that there were some genetic differences. And you may have heard this, that it does seem that more of the people who were hospitalized tend to have the type A blood type, which is interesting. Now, it doesn't, you know, maybe neither here nor there. It just happens to be that there are a bunch of genetic markers that fall along, you know, chromosomes that are known, and there are some, you know, gene sequences that lie together. We don't know that it's the blood type per se or whether it just is in that same chromosome. And so I guess the thing is, we don't know exactly what the mechanism of this stuff is, but we know that when people right now are severely ill or dying from this stuff, it seems to be an over-active inflammatory response, which causes, you know, severe things to happen. They're seeing blood clots, micro-blood clots in the lungs. Paul sent me an article about neurological deficits, you know, strokes, things like that. So people, these are things that are not very helpful. They don't help get rid of the virus. They're something they're referring to as a cytokine storm. But it's an inflammatory process where people are, you know, their bodies are overreacting to the, you know, the burden of the virus. And so they're trying to figure out what is different about those people that get this really severe illness and end up in the hospital, and there are some genetic differences. So despite the underlying, you know, health problems, which we know that's a risk as well, there do seem to be some genetic markers that are different. KE7OLU. Yes, Paul, go ahead.
One of the differences apparently is obesity is a very, very strong predisposition for serious cytokine response. It's not a over response, it's an inappropriate response to the for the immune system, KE7OLU.
Yep. Yeah. So again, there are all these multifactorial things that go on, and that's where we have to wait for these big studies. Like the nice thing about the, you know, this one for the steroid stuff is that, you know, they're on thousands of people. You know, so it's not just a little like 30 people here that, you know, they think it helped. They're big studies, anyway, what. The important thing is that when we start seeing the differences, there was another one that came out today that was talking about a genetic marker that, well, it's basically a receptor for, there's a drug that's used for treating high blood pressure that's called an ACE inhibitor. And it has to do with the fact that when your kidneys are stressed and they're not, they produce a hormone called angiotensin II, which makes your blood pressure go way up. Okay, and in we've actually been treating people with these things called ACE inhibitors, that it's angiotensin converting enzyme, and you know, you can, they found out that early on in treating people with high blood pressure that, yeah, some of people's high blood pressure is because of this angiotensin II stuff. So if you block it, then you don't make that stuff, which makes your blood pressure go up. That makes sense. So I'm just mentioning this because I had a pharmacology background, and this is the basic science part of understanding the way disease works. We have to target treatments when we understand the disease. So it seems to be that there's another drug that they're looking at. In that same kind of high blood pressure medicine treatment, they were working on a different drug that blocked the receptor for the hormonal marker, the angiotensin 1, which seems to actually might also be a treatment for COVID. It seems like it helps with, and it seems to be that those patients that are having, again, hospitalized, that are having more of the blood clot problems and things, might benefit from this drug. And we're not really sure, but they said that it's possible that the actual virus might be one of the ways it attaches itself to the cells in the first place is by attaching to a specific receptor. And if you can block that receptor with a medicine that we've discovered for something else, then the virus doesn't bind as well. So again, once again, a possible treatment for the illness. So that's, again, good news. We're starting to see this happen. Starting to see, these studies that have been done. We have to wait till they come out. But this is good stuff because we're learning about the mechanism of how the stuff affects us. We're just not, we still have to get the vaccine. We're still working on that, right? But we still have to do our behavioral things to keep us safe. But keep in mind that we are learning more and more. Okay, another thing I wanted to mention today was this, you may have heard that the WHO got in trouble because they said, oh, there's no asymptomatic transmission. And it really is I don't know if you heard this about this, but they were like, okay, well, then the WHO is obviously fooling us because we know that's the case. Why did they say that? I hope anybody read that, have comments on that. Okay, so anyway, there are different fact-checking websites that you can look at. And the thing is that I just wanted to make sure that sort of a semantics thing. So we're talking about somebody who is asymptomatic transmission. What most of us know is happening is that people are infected before they show symptoms, okay? Now, it turns out it's sort of semantics. That's really pre-symptomatic, okay? Right? So asymptomatic would be people who never, ever show any symptoms at all, and it's kind of what maybe Dan is alluding to here, and yet they still infect people. Well, and they said, well, those would be rare. There does seem to be evidence that probably is the case, but it would be difficult to find those people because, if you're following somebody who's asymptomatic, I guess find that they test positive, and they never show any other symptoms, you'd have to then follow whether any of their contacts would get infected. And that is, they just haven't found very many people like that. But it probably exists, but it is the minority. It's not the majority of the people by any means. So they can't tell you how big of a problem it is compared to the other kinds of transmission we have. So it's kind of, it's hard, would be hard to study those people and hard to find them. Okay, so let's move on to, again, this kind of fact-checking stuff. I think this is important because of political things, too, and this, okay. So one other thing that came out in the news, that this relates to our own personal emergency preparedness, is these contact tracing things. Okay, apparently they've reported, I think KGW News 8 is warning of fake contact tracers. Okay, so the thing is that if you receive a text notification or an email notification that, you know, someone has, you know, that you've been around somebody who's tested positive for COVID and you know, they ask you to click a link and sign in and give your personal information, it's a scam. That is not how it's done, okay? Now, since I haven't had been contact traced or whatever, most people have not, we wouldn't know that. But you will normally receive a phone call, according to this, from the Oregon Health Authority. It would be a, you know, part of the county health people would call you or send you a letter. Then they will never ask for your Social Security number or any personal information. They're really just going to try to find out, you know, who you know and where you've been and things like that. So if that ever happens to you, just be aware that this is a scam. People still out there trying to take advantage and steal your information. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. We're talking about emergency preparedness. And are there any other check-ins or comments or questions at this point?
W7NAT.
Okay, there's Nate, Whiskey 7, November Alpha Tango. Did you have a question or comment?
No, I just got here about a half hour too late. Sorry.
Okay, no problem. Well, Nate, that reminds me because you brought up something to me, which is, again, you know, we're going through this, you know, experimental reopening, trying to get back to normal here. Part of what you had asked me for is, well, if we go to, say, phase two opening and we, you know, can have a group of 50 people or something that theoretically can meet in a building, you know, should we do that? Okay? And, you know, I was talking to you about that. And the question really is the way you look at these sort of government orders, you know, you can look at them two ways. You could say, well, is this a recommendation or a relaxation of a restriction? And I think the way that we look at these things is that we're trying an experiment here. We've slowed it down, you know, the growth of this thing, and now we're kind of trying things, all right? But it isn't just because they say it's time that you can try this doesn't mean that the government is recommending now, you should all go do this now, right? The recommendation still is for people who, you know, to stay home as much as they can and be socially distant and wear masks and be safe, okay? There will be some cases where we would really, you know, it's important, like schools and things like that need to figure out a way to keep educating people, and there are essential things that need to go on in this world. But right now, nothing has changed as far as the virus goes. Just I want everybody to realize that nothing has changed, okay? There's not enough people out there to say to give the herd immunity, okay? And it's still out there. If you're outdoors and it's, you know, in the summertime and things like that, and you circulate air and stuff like that, you're better than if you're indoors in a room with people. And so we know that, but it's still there. It's still out there, and people are still getting sick, and still cases are still increasing. So our personal risk has not changed as a result of whatever the government is recommending. Okay, another thing I want to mention tonight, this has to do a little bit with, you know, some of the political stuff, and I don't want to get into politics too much. I just want to talk about an important thing about emergency communications, okay? We mentioned this a little bit last week. Once again, I heard people sort of going, you know, out. There's been in the news that people get rumors and they think that something bad is going to happen, that people are going to show up and do, you know, violence or, you know, looting or whatever. And so you feel compelled, like you need to take action, okay? the FBI has an important website, actually. It talks about the issue of disinformation. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about disinformation because, you know, just like this thing with the COVID tracer scam, I mean, there are bad people out there that really would love to mess us up, okay? And one of the easiest ways to mess us up is to give us the wrong information. So it's really, really important to not spread disinformation, okay? If you see something, we know already that just the way that our minds work psychologically, if we see something which is a threat to us or even something that sounds outrageous, it tends to attract our attention. But by, you know, what we have to be really, really careful of is that is not spreading the disinformation. It's if you see something, you know, you see something, I want you, all of us that are, you know, involved in Neighborhood Watch or emergency preparedness, our job is to report information and give good situational awareness and help our community, you know, but it has to do with trusted source of information, okay? If you don't know, you haven't seen, the bad guys wandering around your neighborhood, then they're not wandering around your neighborhood. If you read it on a Twitter thing, it's probably fake. And you have to be, you could report it to the authorities so that they know, but you could say, look, I just got this Twitter thing and it sounds bad, I just wanted you to know. And they'd say thank you, but don't send it to all your friends and family and Neighborhood Watch. That gets people upset, and then they show up with guns, you know, at places, and people get hurt. Okay, what we're told, again, is in emergency communications as HAMS, is that, you know, in ARIES, we do get this training from FEMA, which, you know, they found out over years of dealing with different disasters that it's a good idea to have a command structure and a way of handling messages and official ways and, you know, incident command and things like that. That when it comes to communication, we have people who are called, you know, public information officers, all right, and they work in the incident command section as part of the executive branch there of the operation. We as amateur radio operators work in the logistics communication branch, and we pass information along, but we don't generate it, okay? So it's important, again, not to generate information and start reporting it either on the radio or, you know, to your neighborhood watch or whatever, unless it affects you directly and you have witnessed it. So, you know, don't – if someone tells you something – you know, be very, very sure of your sources before you start passing it on. We don't generate our own traffic. That's, I guess, the point is all of our messages that we send officially come from somebody. They come from a person with a position, and they're sent to another person with a position, and we don't generate our own traffic. Any questions on that?
KE7 OLU.
Yeah, Paul there, if you don't know Paul, he's our EC, our emergency coordinator for our ARIES OXCOM group, and he has a lot of training, a lot more than the most of us on this subject, and I appreciate your comments on this, Paul.
This is Paul, KE7OLU. I would like to emphasize what Brett just said. Do not pass information that you are not absolutely 100% sure is true. And if it sounds outrageous, it probably is. It's like the old money scam. If it looks like too good a deal to be true, it probably is not true. So, as Brett said, we are like the post office. We don't generate letters. We just receive and deliver the letter from whoever's sending it to whoever's addressed. Ours are messages over the radio instead of letters, but like the post office, we receive, transmit to the intended recipient. If there are rumors that you hear that seem be potentially important, call 911 and report it, or call the administrative number for the sheriff or the city police and report it to them. If it's a scam type, the Attorney General, Oregon Attorney General, has a web page that you can report scams, like Brett was talking about, the fake contact tracers. That kind of information can be reported to the Attorney General, and they will investigate it. They will then, if it's important enough, put out in the newspaper a public information a public information announcement in the newspaper or over the radio to let people know that it is a scam, or if it is true, then you will get a over one of the emergency broadcast systems, you'll get information about it. Do not pass rumors that are not verified. KE7OLU.
Yes, Richard, EDF, go ahead, please.
KE7OLU.
Yes, Paul, go ahead, please.
KE7OLU. The last, every meeting announcement that I've sent out on Saturday or Sunday prior to our first Monday meeting has full instructions on how to join the FEMA 60-meter band check-ins on the second or third Wednesday of the month. They also have a digital check-in for that also. So there's voice and digital. KE7OLU.
Okay, very good. Yeah, so that's the repeater ID there. It's Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo. We're up at the top of the hour here. Anyway, just kind of important, though, you know, once again to think about, you know, we are still a community, and we, you know, we need to share information. But, you know, I think part of one of the reasons I like to you know, help volunteer for, you know, as a auxiliary communication person is that we get a chance to kind of figure out, we both get to train and figure out what it is that how the government, you know, passes information around and uses information, and we become actually a trusted source. And so just like when we're starting to, you know, I think the good thing about our ham community, I think that when we get on the air, we recognize our call signs, and we recognize that we're part of a group of people that we know each other. Now, many of us have never met face to face. I realize that, you know, but I feel like I know you all. I recognize your voice. I know your call signs. Okay, so if you were, you know, to get on the radio and tell me something, that you saw in your yard, I would tend to believe you because I know you. But if someone random gets on the air that I don't know and it's a call sign I've never heard before, you know, I wouldn't necessarily believe them. You know. And what happens a little bit with the way that the, you know, these government agencies work is that they do kind of tend to trust the people that they work with more. And so people that are in CERT and people that are in the auxiliary comm units, we have a little bit more influence in terms of, yes, if Paul calls up and says he sees something happening in North Salem that looks fishy, I think that the people at, you know, the sheriff's office are going to listen to him because they realize that Paul is, a trusted source, right? And if he's talking about, you know, he's not going to pass on a rumor, and that, you know, so anyway, part of building trust is to not, you know, is to try to share information that we know is correct and which is helpful, and learning to, you know, we talking to each other like we're doing now, you know, we're sharing information, and I'm trying to be honest with you guys. I'm not trying to fool you, and I hope you realize that, and you know, this is the place where we share facts, and that's really the good thing. But yeah, I'm never going to get on here and say, gosh, I just got a Twitter thing that says, you know, whatever. It's just, I don't even look at it. But it is so, so easy to see something on Facebook and Twitter and get upset about it. You got to talk to somebody about it. But, you know, just say, I saw it on this, and I don't know it's true. But, you know, have you seen that? And we learned that it happened before with the thing with the, I don't know if you remember last year, I think it was, with there was rumors out of California that the fire department was going to take away all the ham radio towers, you know, that they were going to start charging hams. Well, that wasn't true. It's again, a rumor, okay? So it caused a bunch of upset. So, yeah, got to be really careful about the information that we spread. And be really certain of our sources, and tell the people who it matters to, and have a quiet discussion out of the social media on it. Then when something will happen, I think you'll find out that we trust our information, and we're pretty clever people and able to make good decisions.
W1ARK.
Yeah, there's Robert, Whiskey One, Alfa Romeo Kilo. I think I'm going to probably let you have the last word tonight because it's just a little bit after 8.
All right. Well, just a few minutes ago, I heard you say, unless you're an eyewitness. Well, it has been proven many, many, many times that you line up 5 eyewitnesses and they quite often pass it on to friends and relatives. Well, those are completely rumors, even if they're eyewitnesses. If you're an eyewitness of an event, pass it on to the authorities and let them investigate and find out the truth. W1ARK.
Yep, you're absolutely right. That's what I was trying to say, is that you don't want to go all of a sudden putting it on Twitter and sending it off to the world. Because that's what's happening. And the thing is, if you really could trust the people, you know, the problem is that the way that this system works, and I don't know if you've ever used it, is someone tweets, right, and that someone usually doesn't use their real name, and they say something outrageous, okay, and sometimes that's sent to someone else, you know, maybe it's somebody you know, okay, and they said, hey, did you see the, you know, anonymous here on Twitter says that whatever, you know, the sky is falling. And you say, oh, wow, that's really bad, you know. And then, you know, but there's this thing called retweeting, okay. So, you know, you then send it to your friends and say, yeah, you know, and it just sort of quotes that person and sends it on to the next thing. And it's almost like this virus. It spreads exponentially when people start sending it out that way. And all of a sudden, we've got all these tweets and retweets, which then move this false rumor up into the public eye, and then it gets repeated as if it's true. And that is the problem. It is a weird mechanism that is far beyond a person's own mistaking the eyewitness. It is spreading disinformation, and the thing is, it's really, really easy to set up a fake account and just do this stuff. And there are, you know, bad guys, pranksters, whatever, that just want to mess us up that are doing this. Okay, so that's all I want to say about that. So just be real careful about the information. Try to look at the sources, like we said before. You know, when you see stuff and you want to bring it to the net, you know, try to find I don't like headlines so much. They tend to sensationalize things, but read a headline that seems odd to you. Go ahead and see if there's a source behind it, okay? And, you know, if there's a claim, go see if they can figure out who's the person reporting this. Is it a, you know, a reputable source of information? Is it a reputable newspaper that's been around for years? Is it citing a scientific fact that is part of a, you know, a study that's been published, or is it some new thing that a small report? You know, you just got to look at these sources. And it is interesting. There are a couple of things on there. There's fact-checking things now. Snopes is one. There's PolitiFact.org. There's a bunch of – it's very interesting to look at the fact-checking things. And they go through, and it's surprising. You'll see some of those rumors that you've heard and, you know, what evidence there is for and against them. It's actually kind of interesting reading sometimes, but make your own decision based on how good the sources are always there. Anyway, this is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo, and I think if there's not any final check-ins, I'm going to go ahead and close the net here. Okay, so the time is now 8:08 p.m. This concludes the 529 Emergency Preparedness Net. I think Richard's still recording these, although I'm not as exciting to listen to as Dr. Sund. I think we have pretty good discussion here, and we'll have a recording of it made available on the WA7ABU groups.io page. And again, that groups.io, and you know, it's a good place to put questions and share information, and if you find websites and things that are of interest to the group, go ahead and post stuff to that. And that includes, you know, amateur radio topics or other ones that might be of interest, like emergency preparedness. So groups.io, if you're not a member of that, it's free and easy to join. Anyway, this net meets each Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on 145.29 megahertz. Our thanks go out to Dan, WA7ABU, for the use of the repeater. Thanks to all of you who checked in tonight and those who stood by to give us a clear channel. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, closing the net now, 10 after 8. We now return the repeater to normal undirected amateur operations. KG7GDB, I'll be clear.